30 years ago, did it feel like you were founding an institution? Did it have an institutional feel to it 30 years ago? I mean, it's not like setting up the Federal Reserve Bank or something. It was a bunch of people with kind of a crazy idea.
Yeah,
right?
And that kind of depends on your definition of institution.
Yeah,
definitely.
We had done this before in northern Minnesota. So, yeah, it felt like an institution.
Yeah, it was part of the community radio movement.
Institution of people.
We felt the community radio was going to revolutionize communication. Didn't happen, but it did in some communities. It didn't across the United States. It didn't supplant commercial radio with a new model, which is what we're hoping initially, or that it would create a true dual system of co-equal community, public, and commercial radio. But it had an impact. And yeah, no, we definitely felt we were building something.
Well, I think most people, their first experience with public broadcasting was probably through television. What was afoot in broadcasting, in radio broadcasting, that led you to want to pursue community radio?
There were several things that were afoot. One was a paper written called Public Radio, The Hidden Medium, which talked about, you know, everybody was talking about public television, and it talked about radio being, you know, the initial Public Broadcasting Act didn't include radio. That was amended onto it thanks to Lyndon Johnson. But what happened was this paper, Public Radio, The Hidden Medium, really got people interested in a very low-cost way of communicating with people, much cheaper than television, with lots of frequencies reserved already but not taken up. That was part of it. The second part was in the 1960s, something called Underground FM happened. KSAN in San Francisco, WOR-FM in New York. The FCC required that AM stations had to program their FM separately. They were trying to develop FM as a medium. And the big corporate owners didn't know what to do, so they handed over the FM to, like, the young engineers, the kids at the radio station. I was part of the WOR phenomenon, the first station in New York that did progressive rock. Well, what happened, of course, was after a few years, the corporate suits realized that there was a lot of money to be made with FM rock and
more
and progressive
FM
rock,
than on AM.
More in FM than AM. And so we lost control of the stations that we had started or we had worked on. And so a number of us jumped into community radio. That was part of it. Another part were guys named Lorenzo Milam and Jeremy Landsman. Jeremy now runs Channel 5 TV in Anchorage, by the way. And they set up a community station in St. Louis, KDNA, and then one in Seattle called KRAB. And KRAB had a conference of people interested in community radio. And KRAB set up something called the Crab Nebula. And the Crab Nebula were a group of people who wanted to start community stations. Now, Susie and I just missed the Crab Nebula meeting in Seattle by a week. We were traveling by train, and we didn't make it. But Elaine B. Mitchell from Juneau attended the Crab Nebula meeting. And she came back to Southeast Alaska with this great idea. Well, the idea was all the Crab Nebula stations would end in OO, so KBOO in Portland, KPOO in San Francisco, and KTOO in Juneau were part of the original Crab Nebula of stations. And so Elaine got K2 going, and then the idea spread. As people went to Juneau, the idea spread all throughout Southeast Alaska. Now, the Alaska Public Broadcasting Commission was already established stations, but their model was the big AM high-powered station to serve a lot of territory in the bush. So they would set up KDLG in Dillingham and you know, stations like that. And then there was a third group, the public radio stations like KUAC and Fairbanks, associated with the university. So you had three groups of stations in Alaska: the public radio station, bush high-powered AM, the urban fine arts stations, and then the community stations in intermediate Southeast Alaska, Kodiak, that type of thing. And those three kind of all merged together into the Alaska Public Radio Network. But the stations in Southeast were definitely started as part of the Crab Nebula by Elaine B. Mitchell.
Elaine B. Mitchell.
Yeah.
This sounds like somebody I should know, but I don't know her.
Elaine Mitchell was the one who went down to the Crab Nebula meeting and came back with the idea for KTOO. Now, you know, she actually was only part of a team that built it, obviously. There were people like Dennis Harris and Frederick Hawkinson and others who were involved in building it. And then when K2 was built, Elaine set to work building APRN, founding APRN as a network. And we always called her our founding mother. And she was, she always attended our meetings, even though she didn't work at a station. She was a board member and like, but we always called her our founding mother. And each town formed groups. Todd Davis started the group here in Sitka. He was killed in a climbing accident. Todd Davis and Kathy Kyle. And then Marika and Steph moved over from Juneau. Marika was working at KTOO, again, under the influence of Elaine. And she came over here with Steph, and they picked up the organization, which had kind of, become less active when Todd was killed. Some of the board members, like Kathy Kyle and Dan Edelaine, were still here, but Marika and Steph became the driving point. But, the Crab Nebula was very important in development of community radio nationwide. Susie and I started a station in northern Minnesota, which I guess you would consider a Crab Nebula station.
Second cousin.
We weren't an OO station. But we were tied in with all those folks. I mean, we met with them and stuff like that. We went down to KDNA in St. Louis to learn what we could from them.
But in hindsight, when you're talking about the Crab Nebula and community radio, I mean, we say that all the time on Raven Radio. But at the time, when you were founding your station in northern Minnesota, was it still kind of a grand experiment?
Yes, very much so.
Absolutely.
That station we called Northern Community Radio, but nobody really knew what community radio was.
Yeah. The idea that the station could be owned by a community licensee, could be a public station not tied with a university or not tied with an institution like a school district or a municipality, and also be not in a major urban area, was a very new phenomenon. KAXE was probably the first really rural community radio station in the United States.
And did people get it right off the bat when you explained the concept to underwriters or whatever?
There were no underwriters at that point.
Well, just
they were slower to get it.
In northern Minnesota,
some
they
people
got
did.
It, they got it easily in northern Minnesota because we used the word cooperative. And northern Minnesota had all sorts of farmers' co-ops and, food co-ops and stuff like that based from the time of the Depression. So if we framed it in the term co-op, they got it.
And knowing what we learned down there, we use some of the same terminology up here. And some people got it very quickly, and some people were 3, 4, 6 years down the line before they finally caught on.
But Marika and Steph and Dan and Tom had already done such a good job of laying the groundwork when we moved over from Juneau that people were excited about the idea of an FM radio station. It was almost more FM radio than community radio in some ways. As a matter of fact, Dan Edelaine joked, he said, I don't know what the definition of community radio is except that it's got to play reggae.
Okay, that's still a good definition, I think. So it was as much about the new technology as about the new model.
In some ways, FM, yeah. Like, I remember doing a survey and saying, do you have an FM radio? And they said, no, ours is a GE.